This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
The Second World War ended in 1944-1945. But how is it remembered 80 years later? The end of the war has different meanings in different parts of the world. While Europe focuses on the Holocaust and liberation from National Socialism and German occupation, in Japan, the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki are in the foreground of public memory. In India, the end of the Second World War was followed by national independence. At the same time, India is remembered for fielding the largest volunteer army in history during the conflict, with troops deployed in Africa and in the conquest of Italy. Elsewhere, the end of the war did not mark the end of violence, but rather the transition to new conflicts and tensions such as the civil war in China or decolonization across the global south. This GHIL podcast episode is a recording of our event entitled Winners and Losers, Britain and Germany After the Second World War, with Lucy Noakes, Professor of History at the University of Essex and President of the Royal Historical Society, and Frank Trentmann, Professor of History at Birkbeck University of London. Together, they reflect on how the Second World War has shaped Germany and Britain after 1945, and their conversation offers insights into the ways in which the two nations navigated the aftermath of the war and redefined their identities and roles in the contemporary world. The event is part of the Max Weber Foundation-wide series, The Ends of War, which explores different perspectives and chronologies and analyzes the outcome of the war as a justification for current national and international policies.
I'm delighted to welcome you all. My name is Christina von Hodenberg. I'm the director of the German Historical Institute. I'm not the main person here today. The main distinguished guests are next to me. Let me just say that this is an event which is part of a series because we as an institute are part of a series, one could say. There are several German historical institutes around the world, and London is just one of 11 institutes of humanities and social sciences funded by the German government abroad. They range from Washington and Delhi and Tokyo and Rome and Paris to Beirut, Istanbul, and so on. And it was the idea of the foundation to commemorate the anniversary, the 80th anniversary of the ends of the Second World War. And the World War ended at different times, 1944 and 1945, in different countries, by having an event at each of the institutes looking at the specific national circumstances of the commemoration of World War II and of the consequences of World War II in each of these countries. And later on, all of these events will be forming a series of podcasts and articles and videos and exhibitions, which will be available worldwide. So for tonight, we have the topic of winners and losers, Britain and Germany after the Second World War. I'm going to sit down and we'll start talking about the Second World War and its commemoration. And I'll do my best not to talk too much. So just to start with, what are the main differences between how Germans and British remembered World War II, given, of course, that one of these countries won the war and the other one lost the war? Do you want to start, Lucy?
I guess I'd say that Britain were kind of resentful winners, in that there was a sense that Britain had won the war, but to some extent had kind of lost the peace. There was a sense that it was far easier, particularly for Germany. Germany was getting the Marshall Aid. Germany was getting the money. Germany was being able to rebuild and sort of start anew in a way that was perceived as being harder for Britain. But I also think there was, and I think this is probably quite common, I never used to understand it, but kind of post-COVID I do. I think certainly in Britain there was a period in which people didn't especially want to look back to the war. There was an immediate period of looking back in 1945, but then for another sort of 5, 6, 7, 8 years, there's very little, at least kind of public remembering, because I think people just wanted to to focus on a sort of some kind of normality after that. And I think that would probably be much harder to do in Germany, given the upheavals and the changes and the destruction that the war brought about Germany, which was, of course, much more than Britain.
Thank you very much, Lucy. I mean, the big question that preoccupies German society and politics, really, from 45 into the 1980s is what exactly was the 8th of May, 45? Was it a defeat, or was it perhaps a form of deliverance, a form of victory, because the Nazi dictatorship was overthrown? So that's an ongoing tension, and it never really dies down. What does happen is that between the immediate post-war years and the 1980s, the majority opinion shifts. And there is, of course, the important and much-cited speech by the then president of the Federal Republic, von Weizsäcker, in 1985. So what is that? 1985 is 40 years. At the 40th anniversary, von Weizsäcker makes a point that the war has to be, or the 8th of May 45 has to be remembered not as a defeat, that it was actually for the German people and societies, it was actually a form of ultimately shaking off Nazi dictatorship. Now, those voices actually, I mean, von Weizsäcker, it's sort of interesting about how memory works. I would say if you don't talk to historians, so if you just talk to people in Germany, but also in Britain, who read newspapers and so forth, it's the von Weizsäcker speech which is remembered as if it was a kind of unprecedented breakthrough. In fact, if you take the speech, you can find building blocks in any of the decades after the Second World War. So the degree to which the war is remembered as a defeat or as a loss, you know, has a kind of fluctuation, and it goes up and down. In the 50s, it's very much treated as a defeat, and not least because veteran soldiers are very active in the memory culture.
Yeah, I mean, Lucy, you've already talked about the immediate post-war years and the changes in how people remembered or wanted or not wanted to talk about the war. Then you were jumping to the 1980s. So are there distinct phases in how the public, but also people in private, addressed the memory of the war after the Second World War?
I mean, there definitely are in Britain, I think. I mean, I suppose in the immediate, the kind of interregnum, the period when the war is ended, because of course it ends gradually, there's a lot of thinking about how do we want to remember the war and how do we want to rebuild? And do we want to rebuild in a way that somehow remembers the war at the same time that pays tribute to what people have allegedly died for? Okay, so there's a lot of discussion about sort of what kind of war memorials do we want? We don't want, there's a lot of people towards the end of the war writing for Mass Observation. So they ask the big archive Mass Observation, they ask their writers, how should we commemorate the war's dead? And overwhelmingly, they do not want what they call, a lot of people call, useless lumps of stone. They don't want more of the First World War memorials. They want a kind of living memorial. They want to have things as scholarships, hospitals, schools, things that tie in with the kind of contested idea, I suppose, of the People's War, the idea of building a new Jerusalem, electing a very reforming, quite energetic Labour government that changes things, that starts to create the welfare state. So I suppose that's the immediate post-war period, which is very much kind of looking forward. In terms of kind of popular culture, it's the 1950s, of course, 1950s war films, where you start to see the war being reimagined and being imagined in ways that are very different to the films of the war. If the films that are made during the war are being made in large part to speak to the biggest audience possible, to make as many people as possible feel a part of the war effort. And that includes the working classes, it includes people from around the country, of course it includes women, and it includes civilians. The war films of the 1950s are very much more focused on the male military war, particularly often a kind of an officer's war. So it's a slightly more conservative of a small C memory of the war that starts to emerge. It's maybe tied in with the change in government in the 1950s. And then kind of moving on to the 1980s, so you get to move away from the idea of a kind of people's war, a kind of radical war, I think, in the 50s. And that continues to change. I'm pretty sure that I don't think anyone's really tracked it, but you could probably see some changes in the 1960s, particularly after the death of Churchill. And by the 1980s, by the time that we have the Thatcher government in the 1980s, it's Churchill who's become the dominant figure, and it's very much Churchill's people, Churchill's war, finest hour, people united behind Churchill in defence of something, rather than the more radical earlier ideas of what the war was for.
Very interesting. I would do what academics do. I would drop a few footnotes into the discussion, because there's just been a brand new book just been published in Germany on Churchill and the Germans. That's more concerned with how Churchill saw Germany. But actually, it's what you just said is also interesting, because the Germans developed a particular fascination with Churchill, and to this present day, it's quite interesting. I think in the German case, what is, I think, very interesting is the question of, you know, where is this memory? Whose memory are we talking about? Now, normally, people tend to divide it up into public memory and private memory. And I increasingly think that's not an entirely helpful distinction, because there are forms of collective memory and that are not, strictly speaking, official, but are also not entirely private. So just to give some examples, in the mid-1950s, so 10 years after the war, you have the first organized youth group tours to concentration camp Bergen-Belsen. And that's, you know, comes with speeches, wreaths are laid, there are pledges made on how the war needs to be remembered. That's not organized by the state. I mean, that's organized by local activists and clubs and youth groups. I think those things sometimes get written out of the history. So what we have really is we have an official memory in the German case, that sort of central part of that is the National Day of Mourning, which had existed after the First World War, which is which is suspended in 1945, but then revived in 1952. And so that's an officially organized commemoration of the war and its victims, with activities in towns, cities, and villages. So you have that. You have speeches, of course, you know, the chancellor, but particularly in the German case, the first president, Theodor Heuss, who gave lots of speeches on the war, who shifts the register from talking about guilt to talking about collective shame. So you have that bit. Then you have this middle area, something we now call civil society, but it's basically sort of community groups, sometimes schools become active in this. And then you have private memory, which is equally important. And I think the one thing that stands out, and I believe is really we need to accept, is a continuity across the Federal Republic all the way to the present, is that you have parallel memories emerging. So you have an official memory, in which, with Adenauer in the early 50s, you have the Federal Republic taking responsibility for a war of annihilation and for the Holocaust. So Germany is responsible. But then in private memory, you have a detachment of that collective responsibility with a sense of an individual or one's family involvement. So we have surveys where people are asked, you know, what did your family do in the war or under the Nazis? And in 2015 or 2017, 3% of those surveys said, well, yeah, I mean, my family was sort of supporting the Nazis or Hitler. 3%. 30% said, no, we were never really National Socialists. So you have this, some people in the 60s called it schizophrenic, which is a little bit too medical. But, I mean, you have this tension or arrangement where you have a collective acknowledgement of responsibility on the one hand, but in private circles, one oneself, in a way, had a good war. Many people in the 50s, you know, not just active soldiers, but also people who were at the home front, start to develop this counter-narrative of a kind of good war. One did its duty, there was sacrifice, solidarity. And then there was these evil ones, you know, the SS and Hitler. So there's a kind of divorce. I mean, one thing that's interesting, I mean, you mentioned film. Film and novels also tell you a story in the German case, because you had really in the early 50s, mid-50s, you still had quite a few anti-war films. And then it shifts and you have more of a militarist, you know, you have militarist magazines, the Lanzer, as they were called, sort of penny magazines, which tell of the heroic exploits of German troops in the Second World War, and you have that. But the one thing that stands out, which I really, if there's one book on this whole topic, I would recommend, it's a historical novel, which was published immediately after the Second World War by a man called Plevier. And it's about Stalingrad. And Plevier, fascinating character, had worked in many jobs, including cocktail mixer on cruise ships. But he really was a very, very good novelist. And with the help of the Soviet authorities, he was interviewing prisoners of war who had fought at Stalingrad and who were now in the Soviet Union. So from these interviews, he then constructed a historical novel, which is absolutely a brutal statement about the disregard for any kind of humanity and human rights in many of the German troops. That book in 46 or 47 sold 1 million copies, both in West Germany and in East Germany, was put on stage, had radio reenactments, etc. By the early 50s, Plevier no longer matters because the mood has shifted from a recognition of the brutality of the war to a sense that veterans wanted, you know, they wanted their pensions back, they wanted to be recognized. And so in addition to the question of who remembers, it's also the who is remembered. And I think that shifts dramatically in the 50s. So the monuments, like in Britain, you have war monuments. They now include German soldiers, not just the victims of Nazi rule. And you have debates to what degree SS soldiers should also be commemorated.
Lucy, is there a similar phenomenon in Britain by which private and official memory get detached and there's an intermediate realm?
No, you see, that's really interesting. I wanted to ask that question, actually, because I think it's very different from Britain. In Britain, I would say that there is always some kind of similar, there's not that kind of big gap between the two. And kind of more private memories and more public memory or public representations or narrative kind of work to shape one another. So I would argue that, for example, the war films of the 1950s, the men, you know, they're very popular, and a lot of the audience are men who've been in that war, and they want to see their war being represented back to them. Some of the quite brutal films, actually, we forget how brutal a film like The Cruel Sea actually is, but they want to see something of that experience on the screen. And I think, you know, just to stick with that example, if they hadn't wanted to see those films, there wouldn't have been an audience, they wouldn't have kept on making them. At the same time, that, if you like, that kind of the visibility of particular aspects of the war on the public stage perhaps makes it easier for some groups of people to talk about their war and to share their memories and to kind of construct a narrative that they feel comfortable with. Whereas other groups, their memories of the war, that there aren't people that want to hear it. There's not a space on the public stage. And maybe some memories become more kind of constrained within families or simply don't get spoken at all. And I say one memory that has been, one very important part of Britain's war, of course, has been at first absent from and still marginal to a kind of shared national memory of the war is the Empire's War. I mean, it's more visible now, perhaps, than it used to be. And I think I might come back to this later, but I think perhaps some of the reason for that is the recent work that went on around the First World War centenary with lots of projects that looked at the Empire's War and experiences of imperial citizens during the First World War that took place in Britain then, that raised awareness that it wasn't just a white British war that was fought on the Western Front. And I think there's been some movement towards that in Britain recently, but certainly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, there's very little understanding that this was an imperial war, that Britain, though, I think, one of the key phrases that people associate with the war in Britain, and particularly with Churchill, is the idea of alone, very well alone. People would have seen that cartoon, you know, the soldier on the White Cliffs of Dover facing, you know, sort of darkness over the continent in the aftermath of the retreat from Dunkirk. And Britain wasn't alone, it was never alone, but it probably felt alone for a little while. And that aloneness, I think, has become really iconic in the way that the war is remembered. And that serves to marginalize and push to the side some other really important experiences and memories.
Do you want to come in?
Yeah. One thing that makes the two cases very different was that Germany is, in addition to losing the war, Germany's divided.
Yeah.
And it's divided into two very different regimes who confront the question of the responsibility for the war and the Holocaust, and also take responsibility for what happened in 45 in very different ways. And so the outlets for private memory are really sharply different in the GDR, the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, socialist, and West Germany. So East Germany does not see any reason why it should take responsibility either for the war of extermination or for the Holocaust, because they're communists and they were victims of Nazis. They see themselves, in fact, as victors. So for them, 45 is a triumph. And it's not just being liberated, but the GDR starts to create a myth of self-liberation. But ultimately, communist resistance fighters, with the help of the Red Army, together overthrew Hitler. And that creates a very different narrative. But it also means that former Nazi Party members and soldiers have to be incorporated in East Germany in a different way. And so what the GDR comes up with is a kind of compromise. As long as you promise to build socialism, you show a form of repentance, and then that's fine. And we don't need to talk about it much anymore. It also means that the expellees, the 12 million Germans from Eastern territories who either flee or were expelled in the final stages of the war, most of them ultimately go to West Germany, but there are quite a few in East Germany. They're not allowed to any public space commemorate their lost Heimat, their homeland. So they retreat very much into privacy, or into sort of secret gatherings, and they organized tours to the zoo so they can meet with other East Prussians, things like that. So the outlets are very different. I think that's one thing that makes it very different. One thing perhaps we should add is that the two narratives, or the two ways in which memories develop, also have points of contact.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for British audiences, probably the iconic way of remembering or talking about the Germans and the war is the famous Fawlty Towers episode, right? Where John Cleese sort of hits his head and tells his stuff. Now, we have German guests in our little hotel. Don't mention the war. Don't mention the war. But of course, John Cleese stumbles along and mentions the war all the time, and walks up and down with goose steps, yeah, and so forth. And so most British people, when you ask them about Germany and the Second World War, they assume this comic sketch, in fact, actually reflected a reality that Germans didn't want to remember the war.
Yeah.
Whereas as historians, we know, Germans talk constantly, yeah, about the war in the 1950s and 60s. It's not something that you can't bring up. Many people actually want to do that.
Yeah.
You have other, I think there are other interesting connections. One is the veterans themselves. So in the 1960s, you have the veterans of Rommel, the Desert Fox. They meet with their British counterpart in Düsseldorf, and they drive around in original army vehicles, and they proclaim the brotherhood of good, virtuous soldiers. And so there are these kinds of contacts.
Absolutely.
You have youth exchanges. So there is actually a fair bit, I would say. I mean, next to France, Britain is probably the most important liquid dialogue for German memory making.
Yeah. I think it's Tim Grady at Chester has written a really interesting book on the management of the war dead in Britain and Germany, the enemy war dead in the two countries in the post-war period. And he writes about German youth groups coming over here to help to work at the big German war graves site at Cannock Chase. And there's lots of photos of me taken on tours of local factories and things and looking like they probably weren't having the best summer holiday of their lives, to be honest. But yeah, there were lots of points and kind of contact and links. And of course, twin towning as well is another way in which you saw it. So, yeah, well, I think,
yes.
Is it the first or one of the first twin towns is Dresden and
Coventry?
Yeah. You know, kind of link as victims of war and as sort of anti-war. You know, kind of, and also hands that lost the barriers to Cold War at that point as well. So yeah, you're right, there absolutely are. There are some links.
And what does the Cold War mean for memory in the UK?
No, that's really interesting. I'm still thinking about this one, to be honest. I've been thinking about it since the end of the Cold War. And I think I started off by saying it hasn't really made much difference, but I've changed my mind over the years. I mean, one very obvious change that it makes, if you think back to 1984, and to the first big international televised live all-day commemoration on the beaches of D-Day, then there's a kind of difficulty about, well, first of all, the Soviet Union's not there at that point. But there's also this kind of like, there's a slight almost awkwardness in terms of that international remembering, because you are remembering the defeat of Germany, but West Germany at that point is a key ally. West Germany is on the front line of the Cold War. So there's this kind of slight tension, I think, in remembering and a desire not to, if you like, kind of overstep the mark, which of course ends up with Ronald Reagan going to, is it Bitburg, where he lays the flowers on some SS graves, cool, by mistake. But I think
it was planned. It was.
Was it signed? Did they know it was SS graves? That's what I didn't
say. Some journalists found out.
Yeah.
But then they decided that they would also go to a concentration camp.
And they did,
and then
yeah.
Lay some flowers there as well. So basically,
all victims. Yes, yeah. Equality is a victimhood. Yeah. I think maybe one of the key ways that it's shaped the memory of the war in Britain since has been the increasing centrality of the Holocaust, to how Britain remembers the war. And I think that in part comes about because of the changes in Germany and the, you know, geopolitical changes at the end of the Cold War. There's no longer this kind of tiptoeing around things to the same extent, I think. But also, of course, because it makes some of these places more visitable to people from the West, people from Britain. You know, people, school children now often go to Auschwitz. That would have been far more difficult in the 70s or 80s to do that from Western Europe. And you get a... So that becomes more central. It's like, I think it's the early 1990s, isn't it? Or maybe the mid-1990s that the Imperial War Museum opens its big Holocaust gallery for the first time. So it starts to have a kind of almost like a formal place in British sites of memory for the war. And that, but that's also, yeah, that's kind of been problematic because I think that there are perhaps that there's a, not historical narrative, but a kind of a conflation of memory sometimes, which, you know, Britain wins, Britain defeats Nazi Germany, Britain goes to war to liberate Auschwitz. And of course, you know, that's absolutely not what happened. But I think it's part of a kind of a wide movement, certainly in Western Europe, that Tony Judge has written about. The idea that it's that post-Cold War, the EU and Western Europe, the idea that kind of Holocaust commemoration, positioning yourself as against the horrors of Nazi Germany becomes a passport to modern Europe. And I think Britain, to an extent, this might be changing now, but to an extent was part of that kind of post-Cold War movement that centralizes human rights, I suppose, as a kind of central element of being European and being Western European.
Going back to that question about the different stages of commemoration, I mean, we've talked a lot about the 1950s and now 1980s, 1990s. So does 1968, do the 60s or the long 70s make any difference in the way that memory is being acted out or can be talked about in Germany, but also in the UK?
No, that's a good question. I mean, and it connects with the Cold War question. So if we just look at the Cold War for a moment, so we don't yet know that the Berlin Wall falls. Let's just assume that. Of course, the dominant way in which memory is mobilized is through anti-communism. So the wars on the German side is both remembered for Nazi dictatorship, but for many West Germans, it's also, you know, a memory of, look, you know, there is communism and there's the threat from the East. And that becomes quite important in how popular memory of the Holocaust also becomes used. So just to give one example, in 1962, Frankfurt University had an annual commemoration of Anne Frank. And in 1962, the commemorative speech was given by the head of the Hessische Rundfunk, the regional broadcaster. And so he gave the speech. And in the end, he says, you know, this is 1962. So we have the Berlin Wall going up. Mm-hmm. He basically points to the east and he says, look, now there's again barbed wire going up. And he says, people like you and me and Anne Frank are the victims again. And so suddenly, you know, West Germans are potentially like Jewish victims under the Nazis, which is quite an interesting conflation, but it doesn't really attract much comment. I mean, if you have a kind of anti-communist mindset at the time, this makes perfect sense. Against that, you have new social movements and student activists who also mobilize the Holocaust now in the context of the Vietnam War. So you have people walking down the street with posters, which are drawing comparisons between My Lai and Auschwitz. In recent years, often some academics have sort of said, oh, well, Germany is so obsessed with the Holocaust, it suppresses all other human rights violations. Well, if you look at the late 60s and 1970s, that's not the case at all. And the Holocaust and the memory of the Second World War is now put to use to criticize either the threat from the East or American imperialism. So that's, I think, an important conflation. I mentioned the expellees, the 12 million expellees. I think they're very interesting. And in a way, they're barometer about memory culture. Because in the 1950s, they control a lot of collective memory. They're given huge amounts of attention in West Germany. They're dedicated radio programs that play their folk songs from the Sudetenland or Silesia. You have sort of several hundred Heimat homeland museums where people keep it alive. People put up markers, roadside markers, which say, you know, Königsberg, Kaliningrad now, Königsberg, 1,350 kilometers to remember that. You mentioned the twin city partnerships. You have in West Germany towns and cities that adopt, it's a symbolic act, that adopt cities in the lost Eastern territories who are now in Poland or Czechoslovakia. So, it's quite bizarre. But, you know, they're 12 million people. And so I think they play a role in memory culture. They're very, very active. Then comes Brandt with Détente, so Ostpolitik, which recognizes the Oder-Neisse border with Poland, which creates an outcry amongst the expellees because they see it as selling out the rights to the Eastern territories. And then if you fast forward, by the 2000s and 2010s, the Vertriebene have been outplaced in memory culture by much greater attention to Jewish victims. So now if you read their speeches, their argument is, no one ever remembers us. No one ever took any interest in us, etc. And you say, no, wait a minute. That might be now, but in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that was a very important part. And one reason why they're so important in West Germany is anti-communism. For many politicians, particularly Christian Democrats, but not only, these Vertriebene are living reminders of just how much you have to be aware of the threat from the East. These people, in a way, are the victims of the Soviet Union. So they're very important, present, and their memories remain very important.
So interesting. Can I just come back to your question about the 1960s? Because obviously it's very different in Britain, little Germany, and in all kinds of ways. And I think one of the, there's not so much kind of visible public remembering of the Second World War in the 1960s. But what I think you do start to see certainly visibly on a public stage, is a kind of generational gap in remembering. And you can see that. There's a couple of places you see that. So the early 1960s and satire, Boone, Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, all that lot, they do what they called Beyond the Fringe. And they have a very long sketch. It's about 12 minutes called The Aftermath of War, which is all about, it's all poking fun at the memory of the Second World War, and particularly at the kind of war films and people's, what they see as a kind of overly romanticized memory of the war. And when Alan Bennett has a, it's a really gentle part of this sketch, but he does this bit where he is basically being Kenneth Moore, being Douglas Bader, an RAF pilot who was famously, he'd lost his legs in an earlier accident. He was captured, he escaped. So yeah, big war hero. There'd been a film about him in the 1950s. He does a very gentle sketch about him, and that's, people walk out. It creates havoc every time he does this. And I think there's a sense that kind of we can laugh at war because we lived through it. But you, particularly you kind of, you know, young Oxbridge kind of smart Alex, you can't laugh at our war. Because it's only a few years after that, of course, Dad's Army starts, probably the most popular British representation of the war ever. But again, it's a very affectionate laughing at it. It's the idea we can laugh at ourselves, but other people can't laugh at us. So that, I think that's, you start to see a generational divide in remembering in the 1960s.
Humor may be one of the differences.
Yeah.
It's in the way the war is yeah, remembered. Like,
yeah. And maybe also how you deal with the former enemy.
Yeah.
Right? So what role does the remembering the Germans in the war play in Britain? How does that change over time?
So I'm just thinking about the famous Dad's Army episode that's cut, where they capture some Germans. I don't know. You know what? It's really interesting. I think that actually the enemy are pretty visible in British war memories, certainly in the kind of public representations, probably not in family memories and in individual memories, because of course so many people were stationed in Germany at the end of the war and for a long time after the war. But in terms of kind of public representation, there's not very much at all about Germany and the Germans. There's one film that comes out really soon after the war, and I can't remember what it's called, I'm afraid, but a man who's married a German woman and she comes back to Britain, the kind of difficulties that ensue from that. And it's very sympathetic, actually. But they're largely not that interested. British public popular representation is not really that interested, not just in Germany, but in anybody else. It's all about Britain.
Yeah, I'm just mulling this over. What about Le Carré? I mean, if you look at novels, I mean, Le Carré's depiction of Germans and Germany and some of the Le Carré novel, of course, have figures. I mean, what is it called? A Little Town in Germany, I think it's one of them, which has a sort of dark sub-story, which is around former Nazi collaborators being in high office in West Germany. So there are sort of these indirect reflections.
So maybe in that sort of genre, particularly as kind of early 1960s spy novels, maybe that's where you see kind of representations of Germany, and particularly the idea, I think there's just been a book about this, about, you know, East Germany, about the similarities in some ways, as it's understood here, between East Germany and the Nazi state, that there might be differences on the face of it, but actually there's a lot of kind of continuity. Yeah, so that might be one place where you'd see it. But I think stuff that's actually focusing on the war, on the Second World War itself, it's relatively little.
As we're talking about this, it brings back so many things, you know, because I grew up with BFBS, British Forces Broadcasting Service. They had by far the best music in German radio stations. So I remember that. But Dad's Army is something I... You know, even after all these years in Britain, I mean, this is beyond me. It's a bit like, it's just, I don't understand it. Now, speaking about the army, I mean, one thing perhaps to think about and to talk about is also how memory of the war, different memories of the war intersect in the Cold War with remilitarization and rearmament. I mean, that's, of course, in both Germanys, a big topic. For obvious reasons, you don't have the mass demonstrations against the new armies in East Germany. I mean, there's some protests, but not on the same scale. But East and West Germany utilized memory of the Second World War for very different purposes in their approach to military life. So ultimately, after many conflicts and tensions in West Germany by the early 1970s, you have, in the famous words, you have the soldier as sort of a civilian in uniform. Sounds very nice. You know, it's not meant to be aggressive. It's meant to abide by the constitution, respect for human rights, and so forth. It's very much seen as a defensive troop, and you have huge amounts of energy going into how to foster dialogue and community building. The words are all very different from the words that are used in armies, earlier armies, and during the war. East Germany, on the other hand, you have a vehement rhetoric in which fighting is a good thing. I mean, communism is under attack from capitalists and imperialists and fascists. So fighting is absolutely vital. And so the approach to using military language and making children and workers learn how to fight and endure is very, very important in East Germany in a way that West Germany doesn't experience. I think one connection between West Germany and Britain, which is very important in the 60s, is the peace movement. So the Easter marches, I mean, I think it's a year after the original Easter march in Britain that German allies and contacts put that into use in the German case. And of course, one thing, if you look at where they go, is army bases, which means in certain parts of Germany, British army bases. So there's a sort of, on the peace side, there's a much greater flow. One word, because as the German army itself doesn't do humor, it's the allies who do the humor. One thing, I mean, to show you how the West German army, now the Federal Republic's army, was always in a desperate state, is to look at the debates allies have about the state of the Bundeswehr in the late 60s and 70s. And at one point, the German army has these debates about long hair. Now, if you're a civilian in uniform, can your superior officer tell you to cut your hair or not? So you have long debates, and different regiments take different approaches. And there is a phase where the compromise is, okay, you can have long hair, but as it might interfere with your fighting ability, you need to wear a hairnet. So you have these German soldiers at NATO maneuvers appear with their hairnets. And so the British troops said, oh, here comes the German hair force.
Oh, I'm saying, wait, just...
I think that's sort of very good. Sorry.
You want to come in here this
evening? So I was going to make that point about the peace movements in the 1960s. And then that's the same as well in the 1980s, isn't it? The anti-nuclear movements in the 1980s. It's Britain and Germany that are the two European centres for that. And I wonder how much of that comes back to both countries' senses of having suffered more than anybody else in the war. I don't know. I'm just thinking about that when you're talking about the 1960s. But there are definite links there and, you know, kind of sharings of ideas and similar actions.
I think the social and intellectual networks are very important. So if you look at the literature that people are pacifists drawn and conscientious objectors, you know, Bertrand Russell is very important. Americans are probably more important, I would say. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement are important inspirations. But the other thing which is very important in the German case is Hiroshima. So in the 50s, you have mass demonstrations against the stationing of atomic weapons in West Germany. And many posters, you know, basically say, never again. And then you have references to Hamburg or Dresden, but Hamburg, because that's in the West, Hamburg and Hiroshima. So Hiroshima is a kind of reminder. Coventry, I don't think comes up that much. In fact, I mean, it's sort of macabre humor. Germans in the course of the war make fun of the German bombing of, they say, you know, another German V2 rocket concert canceled. So, you know, they say they're not really very effective. So I think Germans actually have a slightly
underestimate the bombing, so that the importance of the Blitz in British memory, which is absolutely central, when I have visitors and I will point out, say, a housing block that was built on a bomb site, what do you mean bomb? And you say, well, you know, they bombed London. And that's the extent of that. It's not quite so present.
Yeah, it's absolutely central to British memory of the war, and it's become more so, I think, almost in recent years after we've built over most of those bomb sites now. But I mean, just in terms, again, of kind of, I suppose, humor, one of the things I found, I did some work a few years ago on civil defense in Britain throughout the 20th century. And one of the things I did in the 1950s when they were training civil defense workers for the nuclear war was they used the bomb sites as places to practice on. It was this idea that it would be like World War II, only a bit worse. I mean, that went on until the hydrogen bomb was invented, at which point they kind of decided to stop that. But the idea that you kind of repurpose these war landscapes to imagine a very different kind of war in the future, and maybe to make it kind of knowable and to convince people that it was somehow survivable as well by using that landscape and using that memory as something that you could train on and kind of learn from, I think is it's an interesting.
I found it fascinating that my children who went to primary school in Britain enacted the Blitz in their first or second year in their history lessons. You both mentioned the 1980s as a period when memory boomed and started to grow and maybe also shifted a little bit from the World War itself to the Holocaust. So why did that happen? When did that happen? Was that like everywhere, or was it specific in the way that it happened in Germany and in Britain?
Well, I mean, Lucy already mentioned Holocaust remembrance and how Holocaust remembrance becomes important. I think the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall is very important there, because the Holocaust becomes a joint European memory project. So it's now how a free and democratic Europe can think of itself. So that really isn't, I think, the important context in the 1990s. But then in addition, what you have on the German side is that I mentioned von Weizsäcker, who is a Christian Democrat. The main push for greater remembrance of the Holocaust in particular and the different victim groups of the Nazis, so Jewish victims, but also Sinti and Roma now, the euthanasia murders, homosexuals, many others, that actually initially, and even in the 1980s, it's a movement from below. So you have civil society groups who are active and who are putting pressure on town councils to have monuments or take down old monuments or revise them. After 1990, many of those generations start to be in positions of power as, cultural ministers or and other functions. So in a way, you have, people who were often called the 68ers. They're finding their ways into corridors of cultural power and authority. So by the 1990s and 2000s, that kind of memory culture now becomes official memory culture. And that's important because I mentioned how the GDR has had its own memory culture. Well, after 1990, the GDR is no longer there. Mm. So you have also an export kind of that West German way of remembering the war into East Germany, which creates its own new tensions. So you have basically two things. One is a European context of the Cold War. And then second, within Germany, you have the growing cultural and policy influence of social groups that had been at the margins, but are now moving to the center. Perhaps, we come back to the problems, perhaps at the end, the problems that creates. Yeah.
And that's really interesting. I mean, I think in a slightly wider context, that the memory boom of the late 20th century, I guess we're still living through, it comes in part, it's driven by the realization that we're coming up to a millennium and that desire to kind of look back and understand and order everything and understand not just the 20th century, but the past 2,000 years, but particularly the 20th century. And of course, the two total wars and the Cold War as well, you know, stand out as kind of key events that shaped that century. So I think that drives a kind of a desire to kind of understand, to talk about, to represent. I think there's also a realization, certainly in Britain, that the generation who've been going and lining up at D-Day beaches since 1984 at least are getting older and they're not going to be there forever. And you can see the impact there of kind of social history and oral history coming out of more academic and community history. So a desire to kind of record people's memories while they're still there, while they're still with us. I think a really interesting aspect of but was two really interesting things about that. I think it's also driven by, you know, the 1980s are certainly for Britain, they're a time of kind of great change, some of it good, some of it not so good, but they're a time of turbulence. And I think that at times of turbulence, perhaps people want to look back and have some kind of stable, comforting narrative of the past that gives you a sense of kind of where you are when things are changing really, really quickly. I think we saw that in Britain right at the end of the war. I think we saw it in the 1980s, and I think we've seen it since 2008, at least, this kind of huge historical transitional times that we've been living through. So I think that's one thing that also helps to drive this interest as the memory boom starts. But I think that there's also, I think, another element of that, and so this probably comes back to the Cold War, actually, in the end of the Cold War, is you start to see, for a whole range of reasons, you start to see in Britain, it's still contested, but more of a recognition of the bombing of Germany and the bombing war of Germany and what that actually meant for Germany and Britain's role in that, and more of a discussion about the kind of the rights and wrongs of that war, you know, even to the extent when we've, you know, we didn't have a memorial to the men of Bomber Command in London. And now, of course, we've got one in Hyde Park, but they're not there as kind of great big heroes. If you look at it, I don't think people have been to the memorial there. It's really interesting. But they're big and on a statue, you know, on a plinth up above you. So you're looking up to them, but they look exhausted. And they're kind of, some of them are looking down at their feet and just an exhaustion. Others kind of looking up at the sky and are meant to be waiting to see if people come home. But that memorial also, I think after the intervention of some German mayors, also remembers those who died in the bombing in quite small letters. But they're there remembered as well. So that started to become something that started to have more of a space in British memory of the war that it hadn't had before.
And this is remembering always a good thing. Can we see this boom in memory culture only positive, or, you know, does it cause or come with its own problems?
Well, Lucy, just you said just now in surpassing, well, you said, at certain times, you know, in Britain, people needed to have, or wanted to have, stable, you said, stable, comforting narratives. And I think that's true for the British context. And that sets Germany apart, really, from, I think, from the rest of Europe. And is the question other Europeans would always ask me, you know, basically, well, how does this work? How can you possibly have a memory or national identity which takes its inspiration from something negative? And so in the German context, I think if you want to have the most optimistic reading, the progressive reading would be, well, it's through memory Germans overcame their sort of expansionist, megalomaniac, deceptive, brutal self. So they learn to be proud by not being proud. That's kind of the version. And then the question that other Europeans ask is, well, is that really sustainable? Can you convincingly ask the majority of a population to accept that? And I think that's where the trouble begins. I think that's so the memory culture, the official, the civil society memory culture, which became the official memory culture, worked with that motto. And so the idea was, everyone will understand that once you're confronted with the horrors committed by the Germans, and then everyone will take that as inspiration. What I earlier called parallel memories,
I think, draws our attention to the fact that, well, that's not exactly how memory works for many people. And I think one has to take seriously that in Germany, not just now, I mean, people always think there's sort of some recent change with the populists as far as memory is concerned. No, I think the alternative for Germany, the populists, all they do is they articulate in public many people's private reservations or skepticisms or simple opposition to this memory culture, but it's always been there. When looking at the German situation, I think where Britain perhaps as on the nostalgic side, Germany as also the error there is being on the very earnest side. And so sometimes reading or following media, newspapers or television in the last few years, it almost appeared as if everything was about memory. And you wanted to say, well, wait a minute, your memory is important, but there are lots of other things that are going on in history and in the present, and they're not all about memory. And why would you assume that if you get the memory right, you get the actions right in the present? I think that's the fundamental problem I have is, you know, I'm all for remembering the Holocaust and the war extermination and so forth, but I think it's a fundamental mistake to assume that if you put people in a site of memory, like a concentration camp or so, they come out of their visit as progressive, enlightened, tolerant, human rights loving people. I think it's a fundamental mistake that ignores that people's everyday life, politics, social outlook is not just a function of memory. Mm. And I think Germany has gone too far in assuming that if you fix memory and if you repeat never again often enough, it will have a desired effect. And I think that's naive.
So as people, they're not a tabula rasa. They're not just a blank slate, blank piece of paper going into that museum or that concentration camp or what have you. People take themselves in there with them. That makes sense. And I think you're absolutely right that Britain has such a, or has had in a dominant narrative, at least a very nostalgic view of the war and a very celebratory view of the war. And I don't think that that's done modern Britain many favours, to be honest. I think that, you know, that constant kind of turning back to this kind of comforting, we were great then, weren't we wonderful then, maybe we could do it again, is not an especially helpful way to imagine, you know, the future for a small island off the coast of a major continent. I think if you say, has it been successful, probably depends where you stand and maybe where you stand politically. It was certainly successful or helpful for those who wanted to leave the EU in the Brexit campaigns of 2016 and in the debates that went on afterwards. The idea of kind of aloneness and a some kind of, and a fear is not the right word, but the kind of mobilization of some idea or a kind of folk memory almost of a Germany that wanted to dominate Europe again. You know, the narrative was, well, they did it in 1914 to 19, we beat them then, 1939 to 1945, we beat them then, now they're doing it through the EU and we can't beat them, so we'll just leave them, that's how we'll, you know. So I think that kind of narrative, personally, my personal opinion is that it's been a disaster.
Yeah. Last question, and then we'll open up for questions from the audience, so you can already prepare your questions. Last question is, do we expect historians to do too much in terms of memory culture? What's the actual role of historians in all of this?
I think we should expect us to do more, actually. I would like to see historians doing more, but it's not just down to historians, is it? I mean, like you said, Dalek, lecturing people, going in to work on memory, just to tell people, well, you're wrong, it wasn't like that. You're remembering it all wrong. And I'm the historian, I'm going to come and tell you exactly what it was like, as you've shown, I think, Frank, simply doesn't work. And it's just, you know, it's not good practice. I would like to see more historians working and engaging with different kinds of histories, working, for example, with community groups and histories outside of universities. A lot of this went on during the First World War centenary. And I think some of us kind of learned how to do this a lot better than we had done before. So that kind of engagement at the you know, a community level, an individual level, I think is really, really important. I'd like to see historians doing a lot more of that. But then I would also like to see politicians and policymakers actually working with historians to think about how we work around memory and how we work with the past. So I'd like to see historians doing more.
Cool. Well, I mean, historians, I mean, you mentioned, for instance, the Blitz. You know, historians, I think, have played an active role in creating that image. I mean, my personal sense is, you know, one has to be realistic. I mean, in the field of memory culture and memory making, there are many different actors, and historians are just one role. So you may have, if you wanted to leave an impact on memory, you may be better off as a filmmaker or as a musician, even a composer. I mean, if you think of Britain, Benjamin Britten's work, for instance, or others. But I think what historians can do is something very important that gets lost in the narratives that guide memory culture, which inevitably have to be selective. So in the things that are being remembered, we don't remember all different historical episodes equally. Some get highlighted, others get forgotten, and some are used to draw straight lines. I mean, in the German case, 1933 in particular, I mean, one sometimes, as a historian thinks, there were only really, I mean, the history of the 20th century was 1933, and then it's the present, and we go from there. And what gets completely ignored in that is that, in fact, you know, in the case of Germany, German history in since 45 has a lot of fascinating developments which have been taken out of memory, which are forgotten. And so we walk around with a sort of blinkered, distorted view of the past because some things no longer even get any recognition. So many people don't know that, you know, rearmament was an enormous political conflict in the 1950s. People just don't think about that when they talk about the reintroduction of or reactivation of military service in Germany. So I think one thing historians can do is to remind us that, you know, memory doesn't map onto the past perfectly. There are tensions, there are gaps. And I think our role is partly to remind the present that there are both insightful developments in the past that got forgotten, but also some uncomfortable elements that don't feature because of nostalgia.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.